It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold, filling in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear what President Obama had to say at his last press conference of the year.
First, there's been a lot of research and writing lately about the quality of resilience, our ability to deal with tough situations and bounce back.
World War Z author Max Weiss was on Central Time a while back, and he worried that the millennial generation was too protected from hardship and that they weren't building up enough resilience as a result.
And that got us interested in tackling the idea of resilience. And we have Mary Steinhardt with us now. She's professor of health education and health behavior at the University of Texas, Austin. Mary, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
Well, let's start and talk about the quality of resilience. How do you define it? What is it?
It's our ability to bounce back and recover from change and other stressful situations, how we deal with adversity.
And why is it getting so much attention right now?
Well, I think there's, you know, a lot of stress in people's lives, and you know, how we respond to change and stressful situations is an indicator of quality of life. You know, and I think it's a lot on. It's a buzzword for athletics, and it's just all over the news. But it's a very real concept, and you know, because stressful situations and change are such a natural part of life, and our ability to adapt helps us grow.
Do you think that resilience is something that, you know, you're born with, or you're not, or is it something that you can cultivate and grow a little bit?
I think it's a combination of both. I think that, you know, that we all have different personalities, and people are born into the world different, but I definitely think that it's something to cultivate. And that's what makes it, I think, such a fascinating concept, is that people, you know, people who struggle with stress and change in their lives can be hopeful that they can develop some resources and skills to handle adversity better.
Do you think that if someone is born with a pretty smooth life, they have their needs provided for, they have enough money, they have a loving home, they have access to education and their healthcare needs, is there a way in which that might actually be doing them a disservice because they're not getting the chance to build resilience?
Well, stress in a sense is good. Stress helps us grow. So yeah, I mean, I do think that you know, we have to have change in stressful situations to be able to adapt to. So you do find that most people that are more resilient have had more stressors in their life. But, you know, I tell freshmen or I tell students at UT, there's no need for us to go out and create things that stress them out. If they just live, you know, we all are going to face adversity.
Well, what is something that someone could do if they wanted to work on resilience? And they're going through a tough patch in their life. Sometimes, you know, the holidays can be tough times for people for various reasons. This might be a good time to work on resilience. Where do we start?
Well, I don't know that, you know, during the holidays, which can be very stressful. I mean, too much stress can break us down. So it may not be the time to have tremendous change in your life. But, you know, a good start would be to remind yourself to own your power, to take responsibility. That's the first thing. So rather than make excuses or blame somebody else or live in denial or shame ourselves, we need to take responsibility. Second important thing would be to focus on positive thoughts and positive emotions rather than the negativity that's so pervasive in our society today. And the third important thing would be to create meaningful relationships that nurture and support us in our lives. So those are the three things we like to talk about: taking responsibility, focusing on empowering yet realistic thoughts and positive emotions, and creating meaningful relationships.
Well, let's pick those qualities apart a little bit, or those steps that people can use to learn resilience. You said owning your own power. That's a pretty cool phrase. I like that. So how does that play out in my life if I'm going through something rough?
Well, we would say if you had a stressful situation that you didn't think that you handled particularly well, try to rewind the situation when you're in a space where you're calm, maybe by yourself, have a little bit of quietness, and replay it like you're replaying a movie, where you can be kind of an observer, where you can just watch and with no judgment. And you identify your position, as we say, on the responsibility model. So How much were you taking responsibility? How much were you shaming? Were you blaming somebody else? Were you making excuses? Were you in denial? So you just kind of watch it like you're a character in the movie. And then you have to stop, and once you've watched a replay of the movie, so you get a little bit of distance from it, you ask your heart with a lot of humility how you feel about the movie you just watched. And you kind of evaluate it. And then you, in your mind's eye, create a new movie, which is an image of what you want to happen. And then, you know, on a daily basis, you you take responsibility for producing that new movie. And you replay that over and over and over again to where it becomes almost automatic, where you can kind of drive home. And as you're driving home, think, replay a situation in your head, identify your, you know, where you were, taking responsibility. Maybe you took responsibility 10% and you're trying to build on that, but mainly you were blaming yourself and shaming, blaming others and shaming yourself. And then you recommit to the vision, to what you want. Does that help? You know?
Yeah, yeah. So are you visualizing this movie? Is that part of it?
Well, the movie is typically, I mean, you could visualize a movie of what you want to happen. I tend to think of that as a jigsaw puzzle. If we had a 500-piece jigsaw puzzle and we put all the pieces out on the table and said, put it together, you would ask me, well, Mary, where's the box? You need to see a picture of what you're going to put together. And that helps you to put it together. You know, you might do the edge pieces first, but when you get to the middle, you have to have the discipline and the dedication to really go after what you want, which is to put that puzzle together. The same thing in our lives. We have to have a vision, a mental image of what we want. And then we have to take responsibility for, you know, for living our life in a way that will help us get our goals. Not that it's not a constant process of readjusting our goals and looking at what's realistic and maybe going down a different path. But we're constantly asking ourselves, what is it that I want and how can I best get there?
Hmm. So is that, you know, part of getting out of the victim mentality? I read a quote from Nora Ephron on resilience saying, be the heroine of your own life, not the victim. Is it important not to be the victim?
Yeah, it's important to accept the reality of what it is that we're facing. But then to try to take responsibility for what it is we want. And oftentimes being, you know, just being realistic yet positive will help move us in that direction. But also then creating these relationships which support us and nurture us, surrounding ourselves with people that we respect and that love us and support us.
So the thing about creating relationships is that, you know, it takes a lot of time. What do you do if you're in that crisis moment and you feel like your support network isn't there? I mean, it's hard to create that moment in the spot because we're talking about something that takes years to cultivate. How do you balance that?
Well, you might have to reassess, are you surrounded by people that really do support you? Maybe you need new relationships. Maybe it's the way in which you approach the people. Maybe there's too much negativity and you're the one that needs to work on yourself. You know, but it's also the little interactions, like how we treat the person at the checkout line in the grocery store, or our coworkers, you know, our boss, and our family, most importantly.
But in general, you know, if you can, you're saying reach out to someone who does support you. That it's better not to go it alone.
I think so. I mean, it absolutely. I mean, it's good that we are able to have solitude and be by ourselves and enjoy ourselves. I mean, people can be lonely in a crowd, but it's also good that we develop nurturing relationships.
Can learning resilience benefit our health?
Yeah, I believe so. Absolutely. You know, people who are more positive or less depressed, they're less anxious. You know, they do take more responsibility. I mean, when we just think of people that are angry, we tend to link hostility and anger to heart disease. If we think about being negative and thinking negative thoughts, oftentimes we can't think clearly. Versus when we're positive, our mind is more expansive and more opportunities and options come to us. And that improves our mental health for sure.
We're talking about resilience right now with Mary Steinhardt, and we're wondering about how we can boost our resilience. Mary's a professor of health education and health behavior at the University of Texas, Austin.
You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about resilience or examples of how it's worked in your life or how you've brought it out in yourself? Again, the number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. This is Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation about resilience with Mary Steinhardt of the University of Texas, talking about this quality and how it can help us succeed in life and lead healthier, happier lives as well. You can get in touch with us with your questions about resilience and maybe give a story about how you learned it and why it matters to you at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email talk@wpr.org. And Mary, in terms of work, that's a place where a lot of, you know, grown-ups feel stress. They've got maybe a lot of things to juggle. Maybe they've got some toxic work relationships going on. How does resilience come into play there?
Well, first and foremost, I think they've got to find, you know, positive relationships. You know, maybe just start with one coworker, but we really need to a job where we like who we're working with and our relationships are good. It helps when people can find meaning and purpose in their work and they feel like they're accomplishing something. So accomplishment at work is very important. Meaning and purpose in your life is important, even if it's just that I'm going to do the best job I can at this work so I can provide for my family. But we all need positive relationships at work. We spend so much time there.
Yeah, that's true. In terms of taking responsibility, now we talked about that a little while ago about owning your power, but what about, you know, the inexplicable catastrophe, a death, a freak accident, the type of thing that you can't take responsibility for? How do you cultivate resilience then?
Well, you know, some people are able to do it much better than others. You know, if one of my daughters were killed, you know, it would really get me. I'd be devastated, and I don't think I could cultivate any resilience. It would take me a long time to get over it, and I think I would never get over it. So I'm not sure that, you know, war when people are killed and those types of things, I think they really take put a dent in our level of resilience. There's some people that go through diseases, and they say, this is the best thing that happened to me. But I do believe that you know, there are difficult things in our lives. The way I look at it, it's like most stress is good, but not all stress. And so if we went to the gym and worked out and we lifted weights, if I'm trying to get stronger, if I stress my muscle and then rest and recover, my body gets stronger. But if I overtrain, I could get injured. If I undertrain, my muscles could atrophy. So we need an appropriate amount of stress, and then we can rest and recover. So stress is good, and it helps us grow stronger. We might plan to go to the gym, whereas typically psychological stress, emotional stress blindsides us. And so as best we can, if we can try not to say, oh, this is horrible, but oh, this is an opportunity to grow. But when the stress is unsurmountable, we need to take a break, and we may need a period to grieve, and we need one or two close relationships that help us get through it and slowly recover.
In terms of rest, that can be something that is the first thing to go out the window when we're under those times of stress when we're talking that you're talking about. Does resilience have a relationship with rest and sleeping and taking time for sort of mental hygiene?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, rest is very important. But resting can come in different ways. You know, if I'm driving down to UT and I one of my daughters calls me, that can be really restorative in just a two-minute phone call. I mean, I bet you, your wonderful volleyball team there beat us last night. Playing for the national championship, and I guess those girls are probably tired, their legs are tired, but you let them get some positive strokes, you know, have a couple of upbeat conversations, and they're ready to move forward. So it doesn't, you know, it doesn't take a lot if what we're really doing is refreshing us. Of course, we need, you know, we need 7-8 hours of sleep a night. Some people can operate on a little less. Some people need a little bit more. So we just need to listen to our body. But rest is very important.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Chris on the line from Adams County. Hi, Chris.
Hi. How are you guys?
Doing okay. How about you?
Yeah, well, you know, we're out here in the middle of nowhere, and it's going to snow on us. So I suspect that that's about the best we could do. You know, the thing I wanted to say, because I've been through the mill. I really have been through the mill. And you have to take care of yourself. That's the first thing you have to do, and you have to learn how to do that. But the thing is, the authorities are out there to just nail you to a wall. They're just like, nobody is pleasant about this. Nobody is happy about this. And people just will come at you. And things have to change in America. I mean, that's basically what I want to say, is that people need to get a better attitude about dealing with people who are at the bottom of society, because they're at the bottom of society for a reason, for the most part.
Okay. Thank you, Chris, for your thoughts there. And Chris, sort of getting at maybe issues of compassion from other people.
Yeah, we need much more compassion in the world, for sure. But, you know, Chris may see 9 negative people, and then the 10th person may be very positive and respectful. And I think the more we focus on that one person that's positive and respectful, and we can build more and more compassion and positivity in the world. But, it, you know, it, some of it is our outlook. I mean, you know, it's just like Wisconsin beat Texas last night, and we can be negative about it, or we can say, wow, what a wonderful, you know, volleyball team we have. Those kids do well academically. They had a huge winning streak. What a successful season. We wish the best for Wisconsin, and they go on and make us look really good in the finals. And, you know, I could worry about it all day and be negative about it all day, or we could move forward and be happy for how far they got. And I realize that's not as devastating as, say, or as deep as poverty or, you know, or abuse or some of the things that people deal with. But at some level, the fundamentals are the same. We have to take more and more responsibility. We have to think realistic, yet it's positive, in ways that support us and help us. And we've got to create some meaningful relationships, meaning and purpose in our life, and a sense of accomplishment in our life, because that's gonna give us a better life.
Now, Mary, when we're talking about success in life, and there's been a lot of research about education, for instance, and the quality of grit, which is another term more or less for resilience, is resilience becoming, you know, the new way to go for everybody, that we should be focusing on this quality instead of, you know, just celebrating someone who seems outlandishly talented at something? We should be celebrating the kid who has grit or the employee who has resilience instead.
Well, I mean, you know, we could talk about what is greatness, you know. I mean, definitely when you turn on the TV and you watch athletic greatness, people are talented. Or if I, you know, listen to some professors at my university, they're brilliant. But the housing and food employee who serves me lunch or dinner with pride and points out the healthy option of the day and wears their wellness T-shirt, I mean, you know, that's and works 2 jobs to provide for their family. In my mind, that's greatness. You know, if one of my kids gets a 4.0 in college and the other one gets a 3.0 or a 2.5, and that's the best they can do, and they're improving, then, you know, I'm proud of them. But I do think, I mean, sometimes I think this grit is overrated. I mean, life is precious and it goes very fast, and we put a tremendous amount of pressure on kids, you know, young kids going through the public school system, and you know, I think as parents, we got to be careful of that.
And Mary, as we wind up here, what are 1 or 2 things that we could try to increase our resilience? The next time we encounter that rough patch, what is 1 or 2 simple things?
I think you could say, oh, now this is an opportunity. Oh, you know, oh, good. Isn't that interesting? This is an opportunity for me to grow, to become more resilient, to build my resilience. How can I take responsibility? How can I think in a positive manner? And who can help me here?
Well, Mary, thank you so much for joining us today and giving us some stuff to think about.
Yeah, you're welcome, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you as well. That was Mary Steinhart, Professor of Health Education and Health Behavior at the University of Texas, Austin.
Coming up, we get the latest on President Obama's last press conference. It happened earlier today. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in a few minutes on Central Time, it's Food Friday. And in the spirit of the season, we'll figure out what goes into figgy pudding.
First, President Obama leaves to celebrate the holidays in Hawaii this evening, bidding farewell to Washington for 2013.
It was a rough year for the president with Edward Snowden's NSA leaks, a troubled launch of the Affordable Care Act website, and lower popularity with the American public.
Before leaving town, President Obama addressed the press and the public one final time this year. Here with us to talk about that final press conference is UW Stevens Point political science professor Ed Miller. Ed, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, Veronica.
Well, President Obama opened his address talking about the economy. What message was he trying to sell?
Right. He's trying to sell, obviously, the economy is getting better. We've come out of a recession some time ago, but it was a very slow increase. But now we're adding, he mentioned, 2 million jobs recently and 8 million over the last 45 months. Also, yesterday they had announced that the economy in the last month has grown by 4.1%, which is a significant growth in comparison to the previous time. So he started by emphasizing how much the economy is improving.
And that's obviously a decent place for him to start, given the fact that it has been, you know, it's been a rocky year for the president. He's had a few rough patches. What was the tenor of this press conference like in general?
Well, I think the tenor was essentially the president was very positive. I mean, unlike his previous press conference, where he was more apologetic in terms of the Affordable Care Act's website and problems of enrolling people, this one he was much more positive on a whole range of issues, whether it's certainly the economy, the Affordable Care Act itself, in terms of who it affects and benefited already. As well as things that the administration is doing. And he emphasized that because that tends not to be seen, that they look at his legislative achievement, you know, president being the chief legislator and having difficulties, especially with the split Congress, but that the administration is doing all kinds of things itself. By executive orders, by creating programs. He mentioned particularly the manufacturing hub, the Connect Addy, which is the capacity, the wireless capacity in all classrooms in the United States. And they're also doing some things actually related to gun control, but by executive order. Now, I know that he didn't mention it, nor did the press mention it, that some of those are being challenged on whether the president can do that himself.
Now, in terms of bipartisanship, the president didn't exactly say, well, those days of partisan gridlock are in the past. Moving forward, we're all one big happy family. Did he seem, though, optimistic that there was the possibility of more cooperation down the road?
Right. I mean, he was more optimistic, although he was cautious. The optimism he mentioned certainly came out of the budget, which he didn't get everything he wanted, as he mentioned, particularly the extension of unemployment. That there is a 2-year budget agreement. He also mentioned immigration, which he spent some time on, in the press conference, and particularly at the beginning, that nobody in the press seemed to ask him about. It's one of his big policies is immigration, which passed the Senate. And Boehner has promised him, he said, that it will be brought up in the House. And he was very positive in passing that. He said he did not want to go back to gridlock. And some concern was expressed when one of the reporters asked about the extension of the debt ceiling. And he said, well, he's not going to negotiate on the debt ceiling because these are bills that have bills paying for expenditures that have already occurred.
Now, he also mentioned the launch of the Obamacare site as his biggest regret. I think I just heard in the NPR story that he actually used the term screwed up.
Right.
And I guess that's what we like to hear from our public officials, that when they screw up, they admit it, and then hopefully they can move on. Do you see that Obamacare rollout as being the driving force behind the public's low ratings of him recently?
I think so. I think that that was one of the major things. And then there was a continuing concern about the inability to sign up. Now, interesting enough, if you look at press reports, you don't hear too much about that anymore because now people are actually signing up. And so now the emphasis is on other matters with regard to the Affordable Care Act, such as the exemption yesterday, which really only applies to a very small number of people who've had their policies canceled and they don't have a new policy. They will be able to take only for 1 year a hardship out so they don't have to pay any fine if they don't have health care.
Do you get the sense that the tangled web that was the beginning of the Obamacare rollout, do you think that that is behind him and he's out of the woods now?
Well, I don't know if it's behind him. I think you're right. I mean, it depends how things go during the year. If during the year, and I expect it to occur, that there would be much more positive on the health care, and a lot of these waivers that have taken place will disappear, you know, next year. And if they get the business small business website working, I think by next November, you know, the midterm election, things will be much more positive, certainly in the health care. I don't think everything will be gone. But he emphasized a very important point, and which doesn't seem to get a lot of play, is that really the website and this all signing up only applies to 15% of the population. 85% have health care and have received benefits, such as if you have, you know, deductions. Most people have deductibles, I should say, and copayments. If you get any preventative health care, you no longer have that. Or limits on yearly or lifetime health care. You know, how much you get. It used to be, you know, maybe $1 million limit on how much health care you can get for a lifetime. Those are all gone. So these are all, and I don't think a lot of people attributed that, and that was one of his points, to the Affordable Care Act.
Now, we've got to talk about another one of the black dogs nipping at President Obama's heels, and that would be the NSA surveillance issues that have come up. What did he say to try to put to bed some of people's fears about that?
Well, what he fundamentally said was that there has not been abuse, that, you know, there's concern. He wanted to balance, you know, privacy and abuse. He says there simply has not been abuse. And he says the concern is a perception that in lack of trust, essentially, of the people. And second, he said potential for abuse. Now, right, so far there hasn't been abuse. Therefore, is what he said was he will be looking very closely at these 46 recommendations that the committee reported to the president essentially on Sunday, but many of them were out last week, the 46 recommendations. The one he seemed to be going with, interestingly enough, was one that NSA said will be a problem, and that would allow the telephone companies to actually keep the data. And only if the data needs to be searched will they then seek it from the telephone companies. NSA seemed to push back against that because of technologically how to do it. And the other problem is whether the telephone companies right now don't keep the data for that long. And NSA was keeping it for 5 years, I believe. And but he seemed to be going for that one in this press conference. But he said he will get back about which ones he will approve, which ones essentially he won't, and which ones need work and maybe eventually approved.
Now, President Obama gave this press conference during the day. Was there any significance to that?
Yeah, I thought that was interesting because, I mean, he's given most of his press conferences during the day, and given his dropping poll numbers, it would have been good, I mean, for him to give it at night, in which he can emphasize this thing, you know, such as, you know, no abuses of the NSA, such as the 85% have been helped and how they've been helped. Those kinds of responses, would have been advantageous to him if he spoke directly to the American people, because people would be watching it at night, much less so during the day. But he chose to do it just simply as a true press conference in the press room, rather than in the more auspicious settings that we've seen before, where the president walks down this hall and stands in front of the presses there. But it's really also speaking to the American people.
You think he was just eager to get to Hawaii?
No, because he could have done it before. He didn't have to do it today.
Yeah.
I mean, he could have done it another day. I don't think that was the issue.
Well, let me ask you one more question. He was asked outright, was this the worst year of your presidency? He didn't agree with that, but what do you think? Was it?
Well, he's had a lot of trouble this year. He did best in the first 2 years of his presidency, and that was because he had a Democratic Congress. This year certainly was a problem. The worst, it's a question of whether it was this year or when the question of shutdown of the government occurred. But I mean, this was in the beginning of this year. But I mean, the Snowden situation has dogged him this year, and certainly the rollout of the Affordable Care Act. So, I mean, it probably was his worst year. He didn't look at it that way, he said.
All right. Ed, thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime. Have a nice holiday.
You too. Ed Miller joining us there, political science professor at UW Stevens Point.
Coming up, it's a holiday food Friday. We'll have figgy pudding and everything.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. The holidays are upon us, and many of us are still in search of the perfect holiday dessert.
Lori Skelton is a classical music host and a frequent contributor to Food Friday here on Central Time. Well, this week, Lori treated us to some homemade figgy pudding, and she's here to talk about what makes it a traditional Christmas favorite. Lori, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here, especially when we're talking something that's chock full of fruit and more than a little bit of alcohol.
Yeah, I mean, can we start with that, actually? Because, I mean, the first time I told somebody that I had some figgy pudding, they made a really weird look with their face. I think people think about fruitcake.
Which is somewhat similar in certain versions of your traditional English figgy pudding or Christmas pudding. It's chock full of dried fruit, currants or candied mm-hmm. citron or some. What makes a pudding different from fruitcake is that you steam it rather than bake it, which can actually be a real help when the holidays are busy. Because unlike something that you have to put in the oven and have to make certain that the oven is the proper temperature and you have to keep checking on it so it doesn't burn, you can steam a pudding longer than the recommended time and it's not going to hurt it. You can also make this well ahead of time. As a matter of fact, some of the traditions around Christmas pudding or figgy pudding say you make it even before Advent starts.
That's a long time.
And then you set it aside. And then
it becomes a doorstop.
No, actually it doesn't. Because what you do is you re-steam it for 45 minutes and it gets lovely and moist, but it's all ready made and you don't have to worry quite so much about steaming it to absolute perfection. You just get it warm, you get the moisture back into it. As we discovered a couple of days ago when we tried to flambé or ignite the pudding that
started
I brought
on
in
fire, right.
And and because I had made it the night before but I hadn't had a chance to re-steam it here at work, it did not ignite as quickly. And so what you do, make your pudding well in advance, steam it right before you serve it, and then if you choose to douse it in brandy and set it on fire, it will look amazing as well as taste just that much better.
What I loved was the texture of it. I love steam puddings and I love how moist that they get when you do your steaming right and they don't turn into doorstops. But apparently there's some forgiveness there. But besides the steaming, what is it that makes a really delicious figgy pudding?
Well, for me, it's the figs. And what I do with the recipe that I've really fallen in love with, the recipe that Dory Greenspan created for All Things Considered, is that you take your dried figs and give them a gentle boil in water even before you add any brandy or rum. So the figs sit there and they get plump to begin with, and then you introduce the spirits and let them sit and talk to one another. So figs for me really do make a good figgy pudding, although there are other fruits. My version has raisins and cranberries and dried cherries, a nod to Wisconsin. But I've been doing some research, though, online, and there's lovely variations on the idea of a steam pudding using orange or persimmon pulp, which is something that some people like to have on their tables during the winter. For something like that, when it's not quite so chock full of dried fruit, you probably don't even need to do the additional spirits or wine or anything.
So here's something that puzzles me. It's called pudding, but when I think of pudding, I think like snack pack or,
right,
you know, like Jell-O pudding. You know, like, you know, why is it called pudding, and why is the stuff that we normally think of as pudding not that?
Well, this goes all
the way. Because it's like a bread, right?
It is actually thickened with breadcrumbs, and it goes back, the first use of the word pudding in the English language goes back to about 1300. Back then, that would be beef or mutton that would be boiled in a skin. And there's some thought as to, is it pudding or is it the French word for sausage, boudin? There's also a dialect of Old English where pud means the belly, something round containing food. So as we move forward, around the 14th century, boiling beef and mutton with fruit and spices and wine became known as pudding. And that was generally served before Christmas. It's kind of like a porridge. But as you added more fruit and sweeter spices and eggs and got it thicker, that's where we get the pudding. Most people in Britain refer to any dessert as pudding.
Any dessert. Any sort
dessert
of like Coke.
It's what's for pud is when you ask
for
dessert.
Huh.
And this is an English dessert, right?
This is very much an English dessert.
Do a lot of Americans eat this dessert? There is something, when I tasted it, I wasn't there right after you flambéed it or whatever you did. Which, by the way, we have the video up on Facebook and Twitter of the flaming figgy pudding.
Flaming pudding, yeah.
Who wouldn't want to see that?
Yeah.
But I had, it was still delicious, and it was lovely, but I thought, you know, it tasted like an English Christmas would taste in a food. Do Americans, have we embraced it the same way the English have?
Probably not the way the English have. I read somewhere that over half of the households in Britain will have a pudding at some point between now and New Year's. So I don't think it's as popular as it is in England. I'm hoping that maybe we might inspire a few people to try it, because I really do think it's worth it. The recipe that I use, you can bake in just your standard bundt pan, or not even bake, steam it. So it's not like you even need any special, all you need is one big pot to steam it in and one decent sized
pan. Yeah, and that's another thing about it is, like, you know, talk about, you know, sort of British desserts and stuff, and it seems like it would be something that would be really hard to make, but it really isn't.
Actually, I think this is easier than fruitcake. Most of your steam pudding recipes have you melting the butter, and instead of creaming a lot of ingredients together and then adding things in stages, a lot of your steam puddings just come together in one bowl. I actually think it's, once you get the basic technique down, it's pretty easy to throw one of these babies together.
So how do you steam it? That seems like the mysterious part. We're used to steaming broccoli and things like that. What do you need to get it done?
You do need a big pot to hold all that water. I believe it was first mentioned to me in Dickens that Mrs. Cratchit did it in her washing copper, the big pot she had to boil water to wash her clothes in. I use an old roasting pan that I can put on top of my stove, put the bundt pan in, sealed up well with aluminum foil. You fill that with water, and you probably want to put a small rack on the bottom of the pan. You don't want that pan sitting right on top of your burners. So give it a little bit of space for the water to be all the way around it. Put some more foil on top of the whole pan, put the cover on, and let it talk to itself for about two and a half, sometimes 3 hours. Again, you can walk away from this, do other things, and not worry that you're going to ruin dessert.
And it's and it smells good, too, right?
It smells amazing.
So it's like edible potpourri, right?
Does that sound good? Yeah. I don't know, Mike.
Well, maybe not. Yeah, that's true. And I think it's illegal in some states. But,
I used a fair amount of spice with this. But, of course, if you're a fan...
It makes your house smell like Christmas, right?
It smells amazing. And if you're a fan of gingerbread, you can even do a steamed gingerbread where you're throwing in grated ginger, you know, grated fresh ginger and candied ginger and the powdered ginger. If that doesn't smell
fantastic.
Like heaven.
Mm. Yeah, that sounds great.
There you
go. That sounds
go.
Great. Now, you still didn't get to the reason why they call pudding pudding. I guess because it's a dessert. And that Bill Cosby probably had something to do with it too, right?
What we refer to as pudding is very much an American and a Northern European invention. What we would call pudding, actually, a lot of Britain...
They would call people, custard.
They
maybe.
Would call it custard. And they would actually serve... custard along with a steamed pudding.
No, so that's confusing.
Only if you really want to push it. Think of it as pudding squared, if you will. And we had our pudding here with ice cream, which is perfectly fine. Applesauce is another good thing to serve with it if you don't want quite as many calories. I happen to be a fan of a lovely warm custard, you know, just having your wedge of pudding swimming in dairy and eggs.
You can't go wrong with that. Lori, thank you so much for joining us. It sounds delicious.
It's a pleasure.
That's Lori Skelton. She's classical music host here at Wisconsin Public Radio and a frequent contributor to Food Friday. Thanks,
and,
Lori.
And don't forget that we not only have that video of the pudding en flambé up on our Facebook page, but we will be getting the recipe as well and posting that. So those are both going to be available.